for more than a year, he says. Looping? Ryder asks. A probe that keeps repeating in endless variations, the tech boss explains. You never have to come out if you don't want. This one is called Forever Eden, and it's his favorite trendy. Mongo is in Eden now, living the life of a prove. He refuses to leave. He loves it there. A thick, grayish liquid oozes from around the needle stuck into the center of Mongo's naked skull. They call it brain ooze, and it happens when you probe for too long. They say that some of the more expensive probes last for 24 hours, but I never heard of anybody staying under for a whole year. So he's living in another world, Ryder says. Or he thinks he is. Exactly, the tech boss says. Can we shut off the machine? If we shut it off, he dies. It's the only thing keeping him alive. The brain stimulation keeps his heart beating. I see, Ryder says. And the reason nobody takes care of him or keeps him clean is because they're all terrified of Mongo the Magnificent? Oh, yes, the tech boss says. There was a time when to enter this room without permission meant instant cancellation. Mongo killed many, often for no reason. To look directly into his eyes was a death sentence. Ryder studies the tech boss. Look around, he suggests. Are you still frightened of Mongo? The tech boss slowly shakes his head. Somebody has to take charge of the latch, Ryder tells him gently. Why not you? Me, the tech boss says, sounding terrified. You had enough courage to bring us here, Ryder says. If someone doesn't take over, and soon, then all will be lost. Without guidance, without a leader to lead them, the monkey boys have degenerated. They'll tear you and your men apart and then destroy themselves. But why would they listen to me? I'm not a latch boss. Neither was Mongo, Ryder points out, until he made himself one. After we leave, the young tech boss seals the hatch, but the stink of what happened to Mongo sticks with me. I'm thinking it could happen to Billy Bismo, too, if he isn't careful. Part of me wants Billy to end up that way, for being so cruel about Bean, and the other part of me knows that as bad as the bangers are, they'd be that much worse without someone to make the rules. What's your name, may I ask? Ryder says to the tech boss. Gorm. That'll work, Ryder says, musing to himself. The Great Gorm. Why not? Meanwhile, the Great Gorm looks like he's going to be sick. The color is drained from his cheeks, he's breathing sort of puffy, and his eyes have this faraway focus, as if he's looking at tomorrow and doesn't much like what he sees. What if I fail? He asks. You must banish all doubt, Ryder instructs him. The other thing you must do is make up a few simple rules. That's what the monkey boys expect from their leader. A few rules strictly enforced. Gorm thinks it over. You can tell he's slowly getting used to the idea of taking over from Mongo, and the more he thinks about it, the more he likes it. If I'm the boss, they'll have to obey me, he mutters to himself. Obey or die. That's the first rule. Ryder nods, as if that's what he expected to hear. I have a request for the Great Gorm, he says, bowing his head. What? Says Gorm, lost in his thoughts. Oh yeah, sure, go ahead. Two requests, actually. The first is that you release all prisoners as a gesture of goodwill, Ryder suggests. My second request is that you banish us from the latch. Have a squad of techs escort us to the border. Gorm looks at him sharply. What? I assumed you'd stay and be my advisor. We have a mission elsewhere, Ryder says, making it sound grand and important. But I do have one more piece of advice. Do not appoint an advisor until you're certain of your men. If I'm not mistaken, Mongo was advisor to the previous latch boss, the very one he assassinated. Gorm glances nervously behind him, then catches himself. I notice he's already looking bigger and stronger. Mongo made his proclamations from the East Tower, he says, eyes suddenly flashing. The Great Gorm will do the same. I must tell him there's a new boss, new rules. Ryder studies him thoughtfully and then nods. The king is dead, he says. Long live the king. Chapter 13. Miles to go before we sleep. Little Face looks scared. You can't blame him. The techs who drive us away in their TACV aren't exactly friendly. Plus a wild mob of monkey boys chase after the TACV, hooting and screeching and throwing stones at us. Every time a stone hits the armor plating, Little Face tries to make himself even smaller than he is. Also, he hasn't said chocks since we left the fort. We'll be okay, I say, soon as we're clear of this latch. That's what I tell him, but inside I'm not so sure. Replacing the latch boss was a good idea, but it's not like he's actually taken control. It'll be a while before the monkey boys get used to the idea. How did you know about Mongo? I ask Ryder. He shrugs. An educated guess. From the evidence, I assumed he was no longer in charge. I didn't know until we actually saw him. Which kind of amazes me because he seemed so sure at the time. I'm also thinking how different he's turned out. Nothing like the pathetic old gummy who was willing to let me rob him rather than fight back. Except, of course, that I didn't end up stealing the only thing he really cares about. So I guess he was bluffing me too, and I fell for it. Just like the tech boss. The TACV we're riding in is dark and cool inside, with soft black upholstery programmed to mold itself around you. Everything is padded and reinforced and armored. What looks like windows are really vidscreen images of the outside, because even armored windows can be broken with the right weapon. If you listen, you can hear the faint hum of the cyberbrain that monitors the weapon systems and stays wide-eyed for danger. They say a really good tactical urban vehicle can think for itself, almost, protecting the riders. I'm thinking it must be cool to be a latch boss, always cruising around in a new TACV with all those techs ready to die for me, and then I flash on the thing on the bed throne. Until I saw what happened to Mongo, I thought that getting canceled was the worst thing that could happen. Wrong. Being dead and not knowing it is much, much worse. We pass into the shadows of the tall steel bones of buildings high against the sky, and for a while it's as dark as night. There could be things in the shadows, lurking, almost invisible things that want us dead, but I can't be sure. For some reason that makes me think of Bean. Is that how the blood sickness makes her feel? Like something is waiting in the shadows to take her away? Is she angry that it's happening to her and not someone else? Is she afraid? What? I can't stand to think about it or I'll start screaming, so I concentrate on joking around with Little Face so he won't be scared. When we get where we're going, there'll be plenty of chalks bars, I tell him. Chalks bars stacked as high as those old buildings over there. Do you believe me? Huh? I have to prod him, but Little Face finally bobs his head and almost smiles, and a few minutes later we're back at the pipe. The techs more or less dump us out of the TACV and take off before we can even thank them. They're worried about the mob of wild monkey boys catching up, and so are we. I was hoping for stairs, Ryder says, looking at where the pipe looms above us, or at least a ladder of some kind. We have to make do with climbing the rubble around the pylon. Little Face seems to be his old self now that our escape is in sight. He finds a path and leads us up the chunks of the rubble. Ryder and me are both panting by the time we make it to the top, but Little Face, he's not even winded. He waits until we're almost there, gives us a big grin, and then jumps inside the open end of the pipe. He claps his hands and chirps out, "Chocks!" to let us know everything is okay. I never thought that stupid word would sound so good. This may sound fried, but the pipe feels like home. We know the place and what to expect, more or less. Even the rats are familiar, and not the least bit scary compared to what we're leaving behind. The rats keep scurrying ahead of us until their red eyes fade into the dimness. "Lead on," Ryder says to me with a grand gesture. "We've miles to go before we sleep, and promises to keep." After a moment to let that sink in, he says, "That's from a poem." I'm too numb to ask what a poem is, but as usual, the old gummy seems to know what I'm thinking. The man who wrote the poem was called Robert Frost. He lived in the 20th century, he says. All that survived of his poetry is that one line, but even one line is a kind of literary immortality. Literary immortality, I say, mimicking his know-it-all voice. What's that? It means part of you lives forever, he explains. The part of you that writes down words. Yeah? And what if nobody cares about the words? Someday they will, he insists. And you can tell he believes that more than anything. I don't know about words that make you live forever, but he's right about one thing. We've got miles to go, slogging along through the pipe, being careful to avoid the rusty holes and the clunky stuff that snags our feet. There are parts of the pipe that echo so much we sound like an army, and other parts we can't hear anything, not even the skittery rats. Ryder says that's because of something he calls acoustics. But I think the pipe has moods like a living thing. Noisy moods, quiet moods, dark moods. Sometimes it feels real peaceful and soothing, like the pipe wants us to feel safe. Other times I'm so scared it feels like my knees are coming unscrewed or something. But it doesn't matter what we feel. The pipe doesn't care. The pipe keeps us moving. I keep expecting Ryder to stop and rest because he's old and worn out, but he just plods along, never complaining. And after a while, I get this idea that inside, he's a lot stronger than he looks on the outside. Sometimes he's as quiet as the pipe. Other times he runs off at the mouth about books and words and other stuff nobody cares about anymore. This one time he goes, "What's in a name, Spaz? You of all people should know." "A name is just a word," I tell him. "It doesn't matter." "No? What about Odysseus?" "Who's Odysseus?" "Odysseus is many things. A name, a myth, a word." "Yeah," I go, "a word nobody knows." "A word I know. And if you listen, you'll know too." "Okay," I say, "have it your way, I'm listening." Ryder grunts in satisfaction. In the beginning, Odysseus was just a man, like any man. But he went on a long, dangerous journey, much as we're doing. And people spoke of it for generations, until eventually, he became a myth. Later, his adventures were written down in a book, and his name became the word for long, adventurous journey. Odyssey. "That's a stupid name," I say. "Oh? Some would say that Spaz is a stupid name." That pulls me up short. I'm trying to see what his face says, but it's too dark. "Are you trying to bork me off?" I ask him, shoving my finger into his scrawny chest. "No," he says gently, "I'm trying to make you think." "I don't want to think," I tell him. Actually, I'm shouting. "I just want to keep walking until we get there, okay? So forget about words and myths and all that gummy stuff you like to spew, and just keep walking." After that, it's quiet for a long time. Chapter 14. Fair Maidens Must Be Rescued. When we finally get to where the pipe ends, the world is on fire. I can smell it from miles away. At first, the scent of the fire is just a tickle inside my nose, but after a while, I can taste it on the back of my tongue, kind of gritty and bitter and hot. The closer we get, the more we feel it in the air. The smoke makes Ryder cough, and when he coughs, he seems really geezy and weak, and I'm worried he'll choke his withered old lungs out. "I'm fine," he insists. "A little smoke can't stop us." Going back isn't an option. If we go back, we'll never find Bean. And besides, everybody we left behind wants to cancel us. So we keep going even though the pipe is starting to feel hot under our feet. We plod into the smoke for a long time. Nobody speaks much. It's like the smoke has drained the talk right out of us. I'm getting worried we won't make it when Ryder coughs out, "We're almost there." The last section of the pipe has come loose from the concrete pylons and it sags down, heading for ground level. The angle is so steep it's all we can do not to slip and fall. But there's one good thing. The smoke is a little thinner the lower we get. It turns out the ragged open end of the pipe is sunk partway into the ground. We have to duck and crawl for the last few yards to get free of it. The first thing we notice is the horizon on fire. It looks like the sun melted, and everything along the edge of the world went up in flames. "Look at that," Ryder says, wheezing in amazement. "They're burning the whole latch." The smoke brings us horrible smells, The kind of stink that makes you more afraid of the people who set it than the fire itself. My stomach is flip-flopping, and not just because I haven't eaten in a while. Everything's on fire in this place. Buildings, stack boxes, street hovels, people, even the dirt on the ground. All of it burning. The scared part of me wants to run back into the pipe and hide until things get better, but my brain knows things aren't going to get better anytime soon, if ever. We're stuck, and if we're not careful, we'll go up in smoke too. Ryder gathers me in a little face close to him. Our only chance is to stick together, he says. The smoke is too thick to see very far, but we can hear the howling of the mob. The same kind of animal sound the monkey boys made, only worse. Even less human, like whatever happened in Mongol's old latch happened here too, only it's been going on longer. Then a different sound comes through the howling. A girl shouts, "Keep your distance, I warn you. Leave me alone or suffer the consequences." The girl's voice sounds frightened, but strong somehow. Like she doesn't really believe anybody would dare hurt her, not even a mindless mob. The smoke clears and we see her. A slender, beautiful girl standing on top of a broken-down takvi. She's not wearing body armor, just a flimsy, shimmering white gown and a silver headband. Howling attackers swarm around the takvi. They've snatched up packages of edibles, stuffing their dirty faces with food. Some of them are waving torches, reaching out their hands to grab her ankles. "I am Linnea, child of Eden," she shouts. "Touch me and you'll die." It's the Prove girl, the one from the Maxi Mall, the one who asked my name. Billy Bismo said if I ever saw her again I should run for my life, because contact between Proves and Normals is forbidden. But if me and Ryder don't do something, she's going to be set afire or torn to pieces or both. "You sure she's the one?" Ryder asks when I tell him. "I'm sure." "Doesn't really matter who she is," he says, his eyes lighting up. "Fair maidens must be rescued." "What can we do?" Ryder thinks about it, his bleary old eyes flicking from the crazy mob swarming the takvi to the thick clouds of smoke that flow from the burning buildings. "Wait here until you hear my signal, then do your best." "What?" I say, "what are you talking about?" But Ryder has vanished into the smoke. I grab Littleface's hand before he disappears too. "Crazy old man," I tell him, "what is he thinking?" A moment later, there's shouting from inside the smoke. "Edibles! Get him! He's got edibles!" The mob hears that, and they forget all about snatching the Prove girl. Howling and waving their torches, they race off into the smoke, smelling blood, following the sound of the chase. Their eyes look almost blind, like all they can see is what they want. In this case, edibles, food, something to eat. Me and Littleface run up to the takvi. The Prove girl is staring into the smoke as if she can't believe the mob has let her go. "Quick," I tell her, "we've got to get out of here." "You're the strange boy," she exclaims, recognizing me. "The one called Spaz." "Hurry," I say, offering my hand. "They'll be back." The Prove girl takes my hand and jumps down. "Why did they run away?" she asks. "I'll explain later," I tell her. "How bad is your takvi? Will it still run?" "I don't know," she says. "They came out of nowhere and surrounded us. When they saw we couldn't move, my techs ran away." "Get inside," I urge her, my eyes searching the smoke for signs of the returning mob. "Don't order me about," she says stiffly, like she's queen of the world. "Do you know who I am?" "Yeah," I say. "You're a dead Prove if you don't shut up and get inside." She gives me a look like I'm garbage, no different from the starving mob. But she ducks inside the takvi. Me and Littleface shove in beside her. "Can you drive this thing?" I ask her. "Close doors," she says, and I'm looking around for the handle when the doors close on their own, voice activated. Of course, stands to reason a Prove would have the latest model. "Forward," she orders, and the takvi starts to move. The vid screens show nothing but smoke and ruin. I'm glad to be back in a takvi, escaping from the howlers, but part of me feels sick about Ryder. He must have known what would happen when he shouted edibles to a starving mob. They're probably tearing him to pieces right now while we make our getaway just like he planned. "What were you doing here?" I demand of the Prove girl, convinced that whatever happened to Ryder is her fault. "Passing out food units," she says with a sniff. "In case you didn't notice, these people are hungry." I noticed, I tell her, hungry enough to eat you. They wouldn't dare. I'm about to ask if her genetic improvement included brains. How could she be so stupid? When someone runs out of the smoke in front of us. Stop, I shout, and the TACV stops so hard we get thrown forward before the restraints can tighten. What are you doing? The Prove Girl demands. How dare you command my vehicle? It's Ryder. His raggedy clothes are torn even more, and there's blood on his arms. He's waving at us and grinning like he's totally zoomed. How do you open the door? I ask the girl. Why should I? She shoots back, looking pleased with herself. Because that old man just saved your life, I tell her. She opens her mouth to make a wise remark, changes her mind, and says, Door open. The door retracts. I reach out, grab Ryder, and haul him inside. The starving mob boils out of the smoke behind him. Go, I shout. Go, go. A moment later, we're traveling at top speed, bouncing over the ruined landscape, crashing through the remains of charred buildings until we find an open path. The Prove Girl settles behind the console and issues crisp orders to the TACV, making sure we escape intact. Beside me, Ryder chuckles to himself. He holds up his arms, showing us the bite marks. They wanted to eat me, he explains, sounding astonished. That's how hungry they are, hungry enough to eat a scrawny old gummy. So why are you laughing? I ask him. Am I? I didn't realize. Relief, I suppose. I'm just glad to be alive. I'm glad too, but I can't think of how to say it, so I reach over and squeeze his wrinkled hand. Good, I mutter. That's good. With the helium shocks engaged, the TACV can go 200 miles an hour, which means we're airborne about half the time. The nav systems keep us from colliding with obstructions like buildings hidden in the smoke, or roving mobs zoomed enough to throw themselves at a high-speed armored vehicle. The Prove Girl stays at the command console, watching the screens and indicators, but the TACV drives itself, obeying her verbal command to take us to a safe place. 3 minutes later, the TACV slows down and comes to a stop. The vid screens show a gray, barren landscape. No people, no buildings, no rubble, no fire, no smoke, no nothing. We'll be safe enough here for the moment, the Prove Girl announces as the TAC-V winds down to idle. What is this place? Ryder asks. Normals know it as the Forbidden Zone. We just call it the Zone, she says, standing up from the console. Ah, says Ryder with a nod. Is it still mined? The Prove Girl gives him a funny look like, how did he know? And then nods. Of course, she says. The mines are Eden's first line of defense. This vehicle has the codes to disarm them. If not, we'd already be blown to particles. So we can't get out and walk around? He asks with a faint smile. Not if you want to live, she says. She hesitates, looking so regal and beautiful and perfect, it makes me hurt inside. The usual reaction to being in the presence of a Prove, reminding me how pathetic it is to be born normal. By the way, she says to Ryder, thank you for distracting the mob. You're very welcome, says Ryder graciously, and thank you for saving our lives too. She gives him a sharp look, like he got it wrong. Oh, they wouldn't have dared harm me, she tells him. They may be filthy and ignorant and starving, but even so, they know better than to touch a Prove. Ryder's old eyes look like he's laughing inside, even though his voice sounds very serious. Perhaps, he says. In any case, we filthy, ignorant normals are grateful for your help. For that matter, we have another favor to beg. She raises her perfect eyebrows. Oh, she says, sounding very cool. Linnea, may I call you Linnea? Her response is somewhere between a nod and a shrug, as if she couldn't care less what a wrinkled old gummy calls her. Linnea, my young friends and I are on a mission. We must fight our way to the next latch and locate a certain young girl before it's too late. Too late? Linnea asks. What do you mean by too late? My throat finally decides to work. I tell her how a runner brought the message about Bean, how she's sick in her blood and wants to see me before she dies, how we've been struggling to get to her. As Linnea listens, the ice in her eyes melts, and for a moment she almost looks like a normal. This girl is your sibling? She asks. She's my friend, I say. Linnea nods. She thinks about it for a moment and then announces, "I shall take you there." Chapter 15. In the Zone. It's a very strange feeling riding through a minefield, knowing that if some little glitch goes wrong and our vehicle doesn't give out the right signal, we'll be blown into particles, like Linnea says. Not that it seems to bother her. She knows exactly where we are and where we're going, and has no doubt we'll get there in one piece. Eden is the center of the herb, she explains, tapping her nav screen. The zone surrounds Eden on all sides, so we can get to any latch by circling through the minefields, no problem. No problem, I ask, doubting her. I do it all the time, she says huffily. Don't you know anything? The way she talks to me, I should be mad, but for some reason I'm not. There's something about being a normal that makes you feel like you deserve it when a prove looks down on you, because they're doing you a big favor just looking at you, period. So I shut up and listen to Linnea, because I love to hear her voice, even when she's telling me I'm stupid. Also, she's so beautiful it hurts to look at her. But the hurt feels good, which doesn't make any sense, but I swear it's true. Proves. Billy Bismo is right. They're nothing but trouble, even if they are perfect. Linnea, says Ryder, sounding very formal. May I ask what your guardians think of your excursions into the herb? That's my business, she tells him. I don't have to justify myself to a normal. Ryder seems amused by her response. No, of course you don't, he says. Because you believe that we normals are a much lower form of life than those who have been genetically perfected. But I notice that you seek out contact with us. Why is that? Just for the thrill, the sense of danger? Or is there something more? Linnea scowls, which only makes her even more beautiful. I don't have to help you people, you know. I know, Ryder says. But you will. Oh, really? Linnea says scornfully. How can you be so sure? What do you know about me? I know that in your heart you are brave and good, he says. And that's not a result of genetic improvement. You can't engineer goodness like you can engineer a perfect nose. What's wrong with my nose? Linnea exclaims, touching it. Absolutely nothing, Ryder tells her, sounding amused. You're an ignorant old man, she says heatedly. You have no right to speak of such things. No right to say you're brave and good and have a perfect nose? Ryder chuckles and rubs at his scraggly white beard. Wait, I understand. What you really mean is, a normal doesn't have the right to speak on equal terms with a child of Eden. Yes, that's it, he adds, musing to himself. You can't help but think that way. Superiority has been bred into you from the top of your head to the tips of your toes, and into every chromosome between. And yet still you come to the latches, first to experience adventure, and then to help. Which proves my initial impression, that you have a good heart, despite your breeding. All Linnea can manage to say is, humph. And then she turns away and busies herself with the console, like she doesn't care what the old gummy thinks of her. Except even a dumb normal like me can tell she does care. Ever since we made our escape, Littleface has been staring at her like he's looking into the sun. When she turns her attention back to the command console, he crawls out of his seat and edges closer to her, like he's afraid he'll get burned, but still he's willing to take the chance just to be near her. Chalks? He asks in his smallest voice. Without really looking at him, Linnea asks, Is this child hungry? He's always hungry, I tell her. Tell him I have no chalks bars. They were taken by the mob. Tell him yourself, I say. How dare you be so impertinent, she says. I'm not being impertinent, I explain, as gently as possible. It's just that Littleface wants you to pay attention to him. That's why he asked for a chalks bar. It's the only way he knows how to talk. Linnea swivels her beautiful head at me. You mean chalks is the only word he knows? When I nod, she says, we'll see about that. Then she smiles at Littleface and goes, My name is Linnea. Can you say Linnea? Littleface crawls back to his seat where he snuggles up next to me, hiding his eyes from the beautiful Prove girl. What did I do? Linnea asks, sounding upset. You did nothing wrong, Ryder assures her. He's a feral child. No mother, no father, No one to care for him or raise him or teach him how to be human. So he's existed much like an animal without language. He thinks in images, not words. How strange, says Linnea, sounding amazed. Ryder shakes his head sadly. Not strange, I'm afraid. His condition is all too common in the Latches, and becoming more common every day. Suddenly an electronic voice speaks from the console. Patrol vehicle approaching, it announces. Uh-oh, Linnea says. She issues a command to the TACV. Evasive action, keep out of range. The TACV turns and picks up speed. What's wrong, I ask. Eden Security Patrol, she explains. We're not supposed to be here. No one is. That's why they call it the Forbidden Zone. Right, I say, feeling dumber than ever. If they catch us, will we be detained? Ryder asks. They wouldn't dare, Linnea tells him, but I'd be reported. She makes being reported sound worse than being detained, but the way it works out, the TACV avoids the security patrol no problem, and before long we're crossing out of the zone into the next latch. The latch where Bean lives, if she still lives, which is something I can't stand to think about, so I don't. Of course she still lives, she has to. Bean wouldn't dare not be alive when we've taken all this trouble to get to her, would she? Something wrong, Ryder asks me. No, I tell him, I'm fine. Uh-oh, Linnea says again, but this time it's not the Eden Security Patrol she's worried about. It's what has come out of the rubble to greet us. Vandals swarming from nowhere on their jet bikes, waving splat guns and forcing us to stop. And there, riding high and mighty on the biggest jet bike, is someone I know. Someone I hoped never to see again. Lottie Getz, boss of the Vandals, boss of the Latch. Chapter 16. In the Latch of the Vandal Queen. Boss Lady, the Latch Queen, Nails, the White Widow. Lottie has a lot of names, none of them good. Nails because she has special razors glued onto her long fingernails. Razors that'll spill your red so quick and deep you won't even feel it. White Widow because most of her love mates don't seem to live very long. She has other names too, names that are only whispers. Names that'll get you canceled if she hears. The first and only time Lottie Getz ever noticed me was the day I lost my family unit. And on that day, Lottie tickled me with her razor nails, looked at me with eyes of stone, and said, "You've got bad blood, boy, and we can't have that in our latch, can we?" Now we're surrounded by her gang the moment we cross into her territory, like they knew we were coming. "Nothing to worry about," Linnea announces, sounding almost cheerful. "They know me here." Before I can say anything, she pops out the top hatch and waves a greeting. "I come to trade," Linnea announces. "Let me pass." The Vandals rev their jet bikes so loud it makes the air feel as thick as jelly. So loud you can almost see the noise shimmering. Exhaust flames scorch the ground, and the Vandals are all grinning in that hard, mean way they have, like they can't wait to hurt something. Lottie Getz raises her fist. When the engines fade away, she stands up in her saddle and stares hard at Linnea. Most normals would be afraid to stare like that at a prove, but not Lottie. "What trade have you?" Lottie demands. Me and Ryder and Littleface are hiding in the TACV and watching on the vid screens, but even so I can tell that Linnea is surprised by the question, like nobody ever dared ask her before.
The usual items, she says, sounding uncertain. "Is there a problem?"
"Yes, there's a problem," Lottie says. "Someone has been running mind probes into my latch. Probing is forbidden here under penalty of death." The jet bikes rev as if in agreement. "I'm not a runner," Linnea protests. "I don't know anything about mind probes."
"No?"
Lottie gets off her jet bike, climbs up on the hood of the TACV, like she's mounting a throne in her stab heel boots, and stands eye to eye with Linnea. All around, there's maybe 500 of her best and meanest Vandals armed to the teeth with splat guns and gut rippers and armor-piercing crossbows. If Lottie gives the signal, they'll fight until they win or die. That's the rule of the Vandals, win or die. And they always win.
What are you hiding? Lottie demands. Hiding, says Linnea. Nothing.
We'll see about that, says Lottie. And with one hand, she lifts Linnea right out of the hatch and sets her down on the hood. On the vid screen, Linnea's face looks astonished, like her whole world just got tilted. The next thing we know, Lottie is looking down into the open hatch. She doesn't seem a bit surprised to find us there.
Two choices, she says, smiling with her teeth. Come out, or I'll firebomb this vehicle with you in it.
We come out. Ryder first, then Littleface, then me.
I can explain, my lady, says Ryder in his grandest voice.
Don't lady me, Lottie snarls, and don't explain.
I see what I see, she says, looking hard at me.
And what I see is a traitor, a rule breaker, a latch runner.
Don't hurt them, I say. They were just trying to help me.
Lottie seems delighted to hear it. Helping you disobey your latch boss is a killing offense, she says.
You knew that.
I nod.
We all knew it, Ryder says.
Shut your hole, geese. I'm talking to the spaz boy.
Tell me, spaz boy, what's in my latch worth risking your life for?
My heart is pounding so fierce I can hardly think, but I know if I don't tell Lottie, she'll slice the truth out of me anyway.
My sister, I tell her. I want to see my sister.
I get the idea Lottie already knows why I'm here, that she heard all about it from Billy Bismo. They say Billy was once her lovemate, one of the few who survived, and that's why wherever there's a latch war, Lottie and Billy are usually on the same side.
Lottie gets in my face. So close I can smell the anger on her breath, like the air after lightning strikes.
Give me a reason, she says, a reason to let you live.
Let me see Bean, and I'll do anything you want. She strokes her razor nails under my chin.
That's not a reason, she says.
I'm begging you.
There's a rule against begging, spaz boy.
I decide maybe it's better to shut up. Lottie's just playing with us. She doesn't really care why we're here or what we want.
You'll do anything, eh? She says, turning the idea around in her mind.
That might be interesting. Let me confer with my warriors. The way Lottie saunters back to the vandals, you know she rules the ground she walks on. We can't hear what her gang brutes have to say. But several of them nod and glance at us as they talk among themselves. A few moments later, she comes back to the TACFI.
I, Lottie Getz, Queen of the Vandals, Boss of the Latch, task you with this. Find me the probe runner, deliver the vermin into my hands, and Spaz may visit his wretched sister. That is my ruling.
Ryder strokes his wispy beard and says, But my lady, there may not be time. We must
shut it, Lottie shrieks. Do as I command, old man. Bring me the probe runner. Do it or die.
Even if we dared to object, we couldn't have made ourselves heard over the air-shaking rumble of the jet bikes or the ear-splitting cheer of the vandals chanting for their queen.
Nails, 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 they roar. Nails, nails, nails.
Finally, she rakes the cool gray sky with her red-cutting fingernails and fixes me with a pay-attention stare that says without speaking,
I mean it, boy. Find me the probe runner or die trying.
Chapter 17. Looking for probes in all the wrong places. The first thing Linnea wants to know is, can we get away with disobeying?
I mean, what's to stop us from finding your sister and then just running away, she asks.
Ryder sighs and looks at me, like he thinks I'm the one who should tell her.
Lottie will have my family unit under watch, I explain. Just by coming here, I've put them all in danger. We don't have any choice. We have to find this stupid probe runner.
Some runners carry messages, but some carry things to trade, forbidden things, and Lottie has forbidden probing in her territory.
She must have seen what happened in the nearby latches when gangs spent more time probing than taking care of business.
She's an intelligent leader, Ryder offers.
brutal, but brilliant. If Mongo had been half as smart, he'd still be Mongo the Magnificent. We're back in the TACV, trying to put some distance between us and the Vandals. I expected them to follow, but so far they haven't. Maybe Lottie thinks we'll have a better chance of finding the runner if she's not around. The trouble is, I've no idea where to start. I feel like I'm slowly falling down a bottomless black hole, and the more I try to get out, the deeper I go. The worst part is I'm dragging everybody else down with me. We must think deeply, Ryder suggests. All of us. Put our heads together and come up with a plan. The TACV rolls to a stop in a deserted area known to locals, and I used to be a local, remember, as the Brickyard. All that's left of old buildings are huge piles of broken bricks slowly eroding into dust. Nothing lives here anymore. Nothing on two legs, that is. Even on the vid screens, the red eyes of long-tailed rodents wink like stars among the brick mountains. On certain nights, the blackest nights, the Brickyard comes alive with a chittering that sounds like conversation, as if all the rats are trying to talk at once. I don't mention the rats, but Ryder notices me shivering. We'll think of something, he promises. Linnea, my dear, do you have any thoughts? If you were on your own, how would you go about identifying a probe runner? Linnea shrugs. I don't know, find where to buy the probes, I guess. That's where I'd start. Excellent, Ryder exclaims. When the old man gets excited, his face looks younger, as if ideas have the power to melt the years away. It has the advantage of simplicity, he says, rubbing his withered hands together. And the best ideas begin with simplicity. Yes, indeed, child, I believe you struck on a viable strategy. If we find a source for the forbidden mind flicks, we may be able to make a connection to the person supplying them, namely the probe runner. An idea blinks into my head. What if we pretend we want to trade for probes, I ask. Yes, Ryder says, yes, yes. Make him come to us. Brilliant. And that's how we hatch a plan to become criminals and enter the very dangerous underworld of traitors who deal in things forbidden in the latch of the Vandal Queen. Linnea takes us to Traitorville, where hundreds of merchants keep their stalls, and even the strolling beggars have things to trade. She's been there before and knows where to leave the TACV and who to see. Let me do the talking, she announces. They know me here, she adds, with her beautiful nose up in the air, making sure that we never forget she's Little Miss Genetically Perfect. Traitorville is this crowded-up jumble of stalls and shacks and security shelters shoved together under the old sky rails. They say in the back times that trains flew through the air just overhead. Trains that moved so fast they made their own wind. Trains that went faster than the sound they left behind. It might even be true, but the trains are gone now, and all that remains is the old elevated track system. Parts of it fall from the sky now and then, but that doesn't stop the merchants from gathering there to trade and haggle, and steal, if they can. They say traitor is just another word for thief. I don't know if that's true exactly, but you have to be very careful or you'll go into a stall to trade for clothes, let's say, and end up without a shirt on your back. I know because it happened to me once. Charlie, my former dad, told me I'd learned a valuable lesson that was worth more than the stupid old shirt. As far as I'm concerned, the valuable lesson was don't bother complaining to Charlie. And like they say, don't give up your goods until the trade is on the table. Linnea leads us to the most densely crowded part of Traitorville, under the rusty metal awnings that provide shade from the naked sun or protection from the acid rain, depending on the weather. The stalls display goods from all over the herb. Boots from Latch West, velvet capes made by the famous Beastie Slave Girls, ironware for cooking, every kind of edible, weaponry,